This is MSCI Perspectives. I'm your host, Adam Bass, and today is February 12, 2026. In recent years, investors have had to navigate an environment that feels increasingly uncertain. Now, this is not because of any single risk, but really because many of these risks are unfolding at the same time. From geopolitics and trade tensions to questions around inflation, today's risks rarely arrive in isolation, and that is challenging some long-held assumptions about diversification. In today's episode, we're taking a closer look at stress testing and scenario analysis. We'll examine how these tools work in practice, how the scenarios are constructed, and how investors can use them to better understand portfolio risk in this changing market regime. My guests today are Thomas Verbrocken and Monica Sixayi from MSCI's research and development team. Stress testing and scenario analysis, well, that's their specialty. We start by talking about why these tools feel so front of mind for investors right now, and what's different about the current environment.
So stress testing feels very front of mind right now because investors are facing multiple sources of uncertainty at the same time. These are unfamiliar events, I would say even one-off for many investors' career. I will mention a couple of examples what our clients are thinking about. First, roughly one-third of global equity market capitalization is now linked to the AI value chain. And the question is, what are the implications if it proves to be a bubble and it eventually unwinds? Or thinking about U.S. debt, the U.S. debt to GDP ratio is approaching post-Second World War highs, and the concern is growing whether it's sustainable. So our clients are asking, is this going to be a turning point for the U.S., and what if similar risks are building up in other developed markets, such as France? But the list goes on with geopolitical tensions, tariff threats, and credit cockroaches.
As I mentioned at the top, one of the key challenges that investors are grappling with right now is how these different risks are playing off of each other and how that can change the way that markets and portfolios behave.
What makes this environment especially challenging for investors is that these risks don't occur in isolation, and some of the traditional assumptions that investors rely on, especially around diversifications, are breaking up. And the stress testing matters in this environment because it's not just about quantifying risk, it's about storytelling. Throughout the process, you're forced to think through the mechanisms, how the shocks propagate, how the asset relationships change, and how the impacts can trickle down in the portfolio, which wouldn't naturally do in a normal condition.
Before we go any further, let's pause for a quick definition here. Stress testing and scenario analysis, they're often used as shorthand to mean the same thing, but there are some important differences we should note.
I think scenario analysis is a bit broader. With stress testing, I would think more about really stressed conditions, stressed market conditions, sell-offs, while scenario analysis is probably a bit broader, can also mean like not per se drawdown scenarios or negative scenarios. Maybe I would also argue that some might see stress testing sometimes as not necessarily having the story behind it, but just saying, okay, the yield curve goes up 100 basis points, what does my portfolio do? While with scenario analysis, I feel like there's more the implication of a story being behind it.
For Thomas, that is one of the defining features of scenario analysis. It forces investors to tell a coherent story about how shocks may unfold.
The goal of scenario analysis is not just to produce that risk number, that loss, that portfolio loss at the end. No, a risk number tells you something about an exposure under certain conditions, but it doesn't explain why things happen or how different risks can interact when conditions change. And that's where scenario analysis forces you to build a coherent narrative. You have to think about questions like what triggers the shock, how does it propagate through the economy and markets, how do different asset classes respond along the way? And that's powerful because it shifts the focus from precision to understanding. So we don't really care if a portfolio loss under a certain scenario is 12.4% or 13.1%. What matters is questions like, what's the transmission chain we're trying to model? To what is my portfolio actually exposed? Which positions matter specifically in this scenario? And that helps investors see where vulnerabilities come from and how a portfolio might behave in an environment that looks fundamentally different from the recent past. It helps building that intuition, especially in situations where the usual relationships, as Monica said, may break down.
One of the reasons that scenario analysis has become so widely used is that it changes how risk is communicated inside of organizations. Or as Thomas put it,
so storytelling brings risk to life for people who don't necessarily have a quantitative background. So numbers and math, it can feel abstract, but everyone engages with a good story. It helps communicate risk to a broader set of stakeholders, but it works in reverse too. So risk teams that loop in portfolio managers or other stakeholders early in the scenario design process, they tend to get better scenarios and more buy-in when the risk reports come out. That's something we often hear in client conversations. So the good news is scenario analysis is more subjective, but the subjective nature actually makes it easier to tap into expertise across the firm, not harder for risk teams.
So how does that process actually work? Where do scenarios start? And how does one move from a narrative to something that you can actually test inside a portfolio?
You start with a high-level topic, like just a question, what would happen to my portfolio if, you know, the tariffs are becoming, reintroduced again, or the tariff rates are increased. So once we have that high-level topic, the real question is, or the first question that we ask ourselves is, what are the transmission channels? So in other words, how does this story actually impact the economy and financial markets? And let me make this concrete with an example. Nowadays, geopolitical risk is very much in focus, but geopolitical stress rarely affects markets directly. Rather, it operates through things, or like it transmits its effect through things like energy prices, trade flows, supply chains, or sometimes just shifts in global risk appetite. So when we're building a geopolitical risk scenario, we're not just asking, what if there is a conflict? No, we're asking, what's the mechanism that makes investors care about this conflict?
For example,
Russia's invasion of Ukraine in 2022, it had a significant impact for Europe because Europe was already energy dependent and inflation was already building. So this was a concrete example, but to illustrate what's for us the starting point, understanding the transmission channels, figuring out if there are conditions that would make this shock stick longer, and then translate those economic effects into market moves that are internally consistent. Because the goal is a coherent story, not just a collection of isolated assumptions.
Great. Chapter one, get your narrative in place. Chapter two, translate it into concrete market assumptions.
We like to start by identifying what type of scenario we are actually trying to capture. And we have, broadly speaking, two main approaches. First, anchoring our scenario to historical precedent, and the second, using our macroeconomic framework. For the first approach, we rely on a baseline research we did a couple of years ago, where we examined all major US equity market drawdowns from the past about 80 years, and we classified them based on their triggers or catalysts. So these include macroeconomic shocks, fundamental repricing events, leveraged liquidity stresses, and non-economic shocks. And for each event type, we developed some statistical descriptions, such as drawdown depths, speed, recovery time. And we also looked at what other asset classes did during the event. So this is a basis. So it provides us a discipline to ground today's narratives in historical experience without really assuming that history would repeat itself. To give an example, one that is very top of mind this week, let's consider a fundamental, even a valuation correction driven by the tech sector. So we are searching for first past periods when we saw similar structural features. So in this context, we looked at previous historical periods. There was an elevated market concentration in one segment, and then it triggered a contagion to the broader market. So the first example could be what happened during the dot-com bubble with IT and communication services sectors in the middle, or a little bit later during the global financial crisis with financials in the center. These episodes help us assess how contagion spreads beyond the concentrated segment of the market. What is the scale of the spillover relative to the initial shock? And then which part of the market might prove to be more resilient? The second approach, how we like to anchor our scenarios, is for scenarios which are macroeconomic in nature. For example, a recession or stagflation, when growth, inflation, and policy rates are likely to be affected. And we then typically start with the macrofinance model to ensure that the scenario is internally consistent. So this model links these macro drivers to asset prices for us. And a good example for this would be our semi-annual macro scenarios in focus publication, where in this January's edition, we outlined three macro paths. First, in a recessionary scenario, we could imagine that economic activity weakens, inflation pressures ease, and central banks are able to cut rates, and therefore the diversifying function of bonds can be restored. In another adverse scenario, in a stagflation, inflation expectations could become less anchored, and at the same time, growth slows, but the policy remains constrained. So in that environment, yields can rise as growth deteriorates, and therefore the diversification breaks down. And finally, we also had an optimistic scenario, a stable outlook, where growth proves to be resilient, inflation gradually normalizes, and the market stabilizes.
Going back to that first approach that Monica talked about, the role of history in scenario analysis, it's an important input, but
we like to use history as a reference point and not as a blueprint. The goal isn't to recreate the past crisis, but rather to understand the patterns that might show up in a different form, maybe today. So the things I mentioned, what's the typical depths of a macroeconomic drawdown, or how quickly markets recover from an economic stress, and examples like that. And like we mentioned, we are particularly interested in what triggered the episodes and how markets responded when similar forces were at play. And at the same time, of course, we are very conscious that today's there's a very different market structure, different policy frameworks, and different investor behavior. So we adapt the historical experience to today's context rather than just assuming the outcomes would match point for point.
That approach becomes clearer when you look at how the team has used history in past work, particularly around questions of fiscal sustainability. Monica explained how they used international examples to understand potential outcomes of this risk, and how they did so again without treating the examples as direct templates.
We looked at what could be the result of the elevated U.S. debt burden. And we went back to historical examples and saw that in previous instances, elevated sovereign debt could either come out in higher inflation or higher yields. So the examples we looked at first for the elevated yields example, what happened in Greece during the European sovereign debt crisis is a good example. So Greece, as part of the Eurozone, had no ability to devalue the currency, to print money. So because of that, sovereign yields surged, especially in the short term, but also the 10-year note went above 30%. Another example for the inflationary response is what happened in Turkey post-2018. At that time, President Erdogan took tighter control of the central bank and pushed for lower policy rates. And it resulted in runaway inflation and the depreciation of the Turkish lira. We also looked at a positive outcome, how Spain got out of the European sovereign debt crisis through fiscal discipline by credible reforms. They restored the market confidence. So, of course, we could say that the U.S. benefits from issuing debt in the world's reserve currency, and also there is the depth of the treasury market. So there are many components that were not there for these other countries that we looked at, but we could still imagine that something similar could happen. So we just really look at the mechanisms and adapt the scenarios to the US.
Both Thomas and Monica made it clear that scenario analysis can become especially important when traditional diversification assumptions fail. In recent research, the MSCI team revisited an idea that they term triple red scenarios.
So we call a period triple red event when three things happen at the same time. So equity markets fall, government bonds fall, and the currency weakens as well. Each of these moves are things that investors are used to managing. But what makes these triple red events so challenging is because they happen simultaneously. Thus, the diversification benefits are removed. So historically, these episodes tended to occur in environments when policy credibility was a dominant concern and not just growth alone. If you just focus on the examples in the US, triple red episodes were relatively common in the 70s. So it was a decade characterized by repeated oil shocks due to the oil embargoes, persistently high and volatile inflation, and weak central bank credibility. Then a bit later on in the 80s, it had a different character because we saw multiple shorter triple red periods, because after the 70s, inflation was eventually brought under control by monetary tightening, but the transition was volatile, yields moved sharply, policy uncertainty remained high, and the dollar became a major source of instability. In 85, in the Plaza Accord, the G5 nations took a coordinated action to weaken the overvalued US dollar. And then for a long time, and particularly from 2000 until recently, markets operated in a regime where inflation was low and stable. And in this environment, bonds reliably hedged equity risk. And the triple red events were more or less absent during this time. However, they reemerged last year during the tariff turmoil. And we again saw a few days this January during the Greenland tensions. And it suggests that the underlying drivers of markets may be shifting, and that credibility might matter more than growth alone.
What makes recent triple red episodes especially notable is that they may point to a broader shift in market regime. The return of triple red after a generation of being dormant may cause concern on its own, but it's also important to note that they're not appearing in isolation.
They're emerging alongside some structural changes in the macro environment. So we have higher and more uncertain inflation for a while now. We have rising fiscal pressures. We have growing questions around policy credibility. So all of these things are kind of piling up, and that gives, makes it a bit more scary when then these triple red episodes occur. And what makes it really bad for investors, that's of course, like this, the diversification benefits that disappear, because many investors hold bonds in their portfolios to provide a cushion when equities sell off, so they smooth out the repricing. But then, if we look at the historical drawdowns that we that Monica discussed going back 80 years, then that diversification benefit was not there before the 2000s. It was there from 2000 to 2020, and now we're again seeing a period where those diversification benefits disappear. So then when the equity market sells off, also bonds lose and investors get hit with a double whammy. And in case of triple red for foreign investors, you also have another loss coming from the dollar selling off. So that's what makes these triple red periods scary for investors.
Let's turn the page now and get to chapter 3, putting scenario analysis into practice. Scenarios often start with global assumptions, but they are rarely used in a one-size-fits-all kind of way.
What we talked about is around scenario design. How do I go from a story to a set of broad market factor shocks, like what happens to the U.S. equity market, what happens to the 10-year treasury yield, what happens to the dollar, and that's kind of how you describe a scenario in kind of more quantitative terms. But the end step is to translate or, propagate those market shocks to an entire portfolio and see how that portfolio reacts. Then you clearly see there is a link between what are you shocking and what is your portfolio consisting of. So if you're a non-US investor and you hold a very large part of your portfolio in, let's say, European equities, you may want to modify the scenario that we put out there with a bit more detail on, okay, what does this mean for Europe? Maybe you want to have some specific assumptions for the European equity market, for the European interest rates, for the euro, and so on. And in some cases, a scenario can be focused just on one region. Like we put out a scenario around the uncertainty in Japanese government bond markets and the uncertainty coming from elections there, which focuses specifically on Japan. And what we try to do with our scenario analysis is to, put out topics there that, many investors care about. But ultimately, it's our clients, the investors, that have to be comfortable with the story they're telling. And often they're modifying, adding some assumptions, tweaking some assumptions to tell their own story. And ours was just kind of the starting point of that journey, if you want.
So how does this fit alongside more traditional risk tools?
Investment horizon is a very important concept here. So depending on the segment of financial markets, you may have a very short horizon or your horizon may be very long, like for asset owners. There's also like different use cases, like often stress testing is done for regulation, or in other cases, it's around, internal risk management. For example, the COVID outbreak, the situation was developing so quickly that stress testing is a perfect tool there to, as the situation progresses, keep modifying the scenario and understand, internally what is really happening here, how will our portfolios respond to that. And I think that's also one of the moments when stress testing and scenario analysis really took off. That was during the global financial crisis, when at that time, banking regulation was mostly focused on value at risk, like a distributional risk measure. But in the middle of the financial crisis, the regulators needed to know which is the next bank that might fall, which might be the next domino to fall. And that's when stress testing was introduced to really try to understand in the middle of the crisis, okay, well, what could happen next? And that kind of also illustrates how, more traditional or distributional risk metrics like value at risk and scenario analysis can live side by side.
As we wrapped up, I asked Monica and Thomas what they would want investors, our listeners, to take away from this discussion. The epilogue of our tale, if you will.
For me, stress testing is most powerful because it can help to uncover the blind spots investors might have about their portfolio. We've talked about regime changes. So I think stress testing is great to uncover the hidden vulnerabilities of the portfolio, because in another regime, we might not be as diversified as we thought we were in normal conditions.
I would say don't get too focused on that P&L number at the bottom of the page. That number is probably the least important part. What matters is the journey, how you get to that number. And basically by doing that, you create a shared language for risk in the firm. So you give risk teams and portfolio managers something concrete to discuss and build on together. And that collaboration, getting different perspectives into the room early often produces the best insights.
That's all for this episode. My thanks again to Thomas and Monica. And you can find more of their work on stress testing and scenario analysis, as well as the potential ramifications of further Triple Red episodes, on the Research and Insights section of MSCI.com. Next up on the program, we'll be marking an important moment for the firm and, dare I say, the industry, as we say goodbye to Baer Pettit, president of MSCI. In an exclusive one-on-one interview, Baer reflects on more than 25 years at the company, the lessons he's learned along the way, and what he's curious about next. Until then, I'm your host, Adam Bass, and this is MSCI Perspectives. Thanks for listening.